Oh, hey. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Cock Die Podcast. I'm your host, Gary. In case you're new to the show, I'm the editor and official dodgeball referee here at fortnerd.com. Dodge, dip, duck, dive, dodge, dungeons, dragons. Those are the D's of dodgeball, right? You may have seen me as the DM for Quest for the Cure or Icehold's Rime of the Frostmaiden, as Cicero on Cyberpunk Independence, as Doc on Scribes and Scrolls, or sailing on the SS Failboat over on Talon and Claw. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to the show or follow us on social media at fortnerd.com. That's at fortnerd, D-O-T-C-O-M. Or both. Both works for me, but whatever works for you is fine. There's a bunch I want to talk about, so let's get into it. Today, D&D announced their first big cast of D&D Live 21, and it is a doozy. The DM for what's being called Lost Odyssey Last Light is Kate Welch, and the players include Reggie Watts, Lauren Lupkus, Jay and Silent Bob themselves, Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith, and Jack Black. Plus, on top of those five, there's a secret guest. The cast is already incredible, and you're adding a secret guest? Be still, my beating heart. Into the Motherlands goes into its final days, and is just $20,000 away from 300K. It's been an incredible run for Tanya DePass & Co., with interviews in Forbes, Polygon, and of course, on this fine program as well. At $300,000, they're including a stretch goal for rules for building your own ships. And I want my own ship, y'all. If you haven't checked out their stuff, you still have 3 days to do it. I'll drop a link in the show notes. Please don't hesitate. It's also not too late to win a seat to join Ed Greenwood & Co. in a few weeks for Quest for the Cure. It's true. For a contribution of $25, you're entered to win. In fact, for every $25 you contribute to the quest, you get a chance to win. Donate $100 and that's four chances. The deadline, though, is next Wednesday, June 23rd, so you don't have a ton of time left. Get your contributions in for your chance to win. You can learn more at jessiesjourney.com/questforthecure. Now, to my guest for today. It's Strix. She's an award-winning game designer, the project narrative director for a secret AAA D&D video game for Hidden Path Entertainment. She's a contributor to D&D's Van Richten Guide to Ravenloft, and she's passionate about stories. I had an incredible chat with her about her career, great stories, and what comes next. Unfortunately, a lot of it's under NDA. I hope you enjoy my chat with Strix. Hey, Strix, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
I'm super glad to be here, Gary, and excited to talk about RPGs. Thanks for inviting me.
I always like to get a sense of people's journey in gaming, because we all have this passion that unites us. So I'm curious, what was your first experience with gaming in general? Was it video games? Was it tabletop? How did you get introduced to gaming?
My gaming history is very long, and it starts before birth, actually. Okay. So my mom, when she was pregnant with me, bought the original Nintendo because it had come out like the months before I was born. And when she was at home, you know, dealing with me being very large in her stomach, she would play Mario and like, you know, Adventure Island and all the other stuff. And so when I was born, like, the Nintendo was around. So I pretty much learned how to play video games at the same time I learned how to walk, because you can play video games easier than walking, it turns out. If you have small kids, you probably know this. Yeah. I started out with the original Nintendo, and I was like, games are really cool. I love playing them. But, you know, there was an element that was anemic or missing in a lot of video games at that time, which was like real narrative, like taking you to a different place in your head. Because I also read a bunch, like I read Lord of the Rings when I was like 12 or whatever. Like, I loved fantasy and science fiction. And I also got that from my mom. So shout out to my mom for shaping who I am. And then we finally got a computer with internet at our house. And I found play-by-post role playing. So in the old days, you would like post a thing and then someone would like respond with what their character does. And then you respond with what your character does. And it's purely narrative. There was actually no mechanics other than like respect other people's storytelling and like don't God mode. Don't be super powerful or unbeatable or boring. So that is where I also learned how to lean into failing as like part of good storytelling in gaming. Like, it's much more interesting if, like, you die or something tragic happens, or you're like, how am I going to get out of this awful thing that I've made for myself, than being like, you know, power fantasies. Like, power fantasy was definitely a part of it, but also it gave me the comfort space to be like, well, what if I do this really horrible thing to my character? Oh, that's really fun, was the lesson that I learned. So I grew from Play by Post and like Mushes and Muds to tabletop in high school, and that was D&D. It didn't go very well. It was a group of all boys and me, and they were not very mature. So I could tell you some stories. And then in college, I was in like a 2-year-long campaign with my best friends, and it was great. It was 3.5 D&D. And then I started LARPing. LARPing is like role-playing on crack. Like, it's just your whole body is experiencing the character and its emotions and interacting with other people. So I actually ended up running a tri-state Legends of the Five Rings LARP with different sub-communities in different cities with an integrated story for 2 years. And that's really where I gained a lot of my chops in narrative design. Cause like, you are designing a game on the fly in a live setting with like 30 or 40 people constantly like churning through their narrative and figuring out what's next and wanting to have emotions and then, you know, fall and then rise. And I was the architect of all of that. Instead of just being a player, I played the NPCs. I structured the box in which people explored the game. And I was like, I really like this. and then I met my now husband, Ajit George, sometime later, like 2013, 2014. And he was a part of the indie games community on Google+, when Google+ still existed. It was the bastion of indie games. It was wonderful. I really miss it. But I just got more involved with the conversation around games. And there were brilliant designers like Jason Morningstar, John Harper, like Avery Adler, like the best. And I just had access to them as friends. So eventually I got asked to write for a tabletop game. It was for Urban Shadows, Magpie Games. And I actually refused. I was like, you don't want me. Like, I don't do these things. And they eventually convinced me, and I wrote on that. And I remember getting the check in the mail, and I actually like held it up, and I was like, oh no, I want to do this forever. Forever. Like, it just was, and it was like not that much, but it was like, oh, it clicked finally that like this is a career. So I went on to co-create Bluebird's Bride with Marissa Kelly and Sarah Richardson, highly awarded and lauded game that's feminine horror, that's really terrifying, and it was well received. And I leveraged that into video game work. So I worked on Saved K2, writing procedural narrative lines, which procedural narrative is actually really hard to do. And I went straight into that from tabletop. I joined the E-Line team and made Beyond Blue. And then I joined my current workplace, Hidden Path, where I helped get Raccoon Lagoon out the door, which is kind of like Stardew Valley-esque VR game. I made Hala Vista with Aconyte, which is a mobile game, which makes people cry. I love making people cry. And it's actually has more awards now than Bluebeard's Bride did. So it's doing extremely well. I'm now on this AAA massive D&D game as the narrative director for the game. So Gary, I'm happy as a clam, but it's been a long, constant journey.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about that journey, but I have a question first, because I was most interested in your bio that you have a master's degree in mythological studies.
Yes.
And as somebody who has an equally entertaining degree, I am a former Egyptian archaeologist. I'm curious, which myth or mythology captured your attention most when you're studying? Which of them has stuck with you, and what drew you to that to begin with?
Yeah, so I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, and I was actually going for my PhD, and I passed my quals and everything. But when it came time for the dissertation, my dissertation was going to be Bluebeard's Bride, and I was not willing to have the university own it. You know, it's mine. And I ended up leaving with my master's, which I think was a very good choice, because like, I'm a doer. I want to produce, I want to engage. And you, during your PhD, you're just kind of like processing other people's work. And I wasn't willing to wait 3 years to get into the industry. It's a long time, or 4 years. It's a PhD. And so the reason why I was at Pacifica and why I was in this myth program is honestly because I felt super drawn to it. It was just important. I knew what the potential outcomes of getting this degree were, which is there's no mythology departments in any university. I would have to squeeze into a lit department or an archaeology department or whatever, or just not find work if I wanted to be an academic, because I was considering it at the time. But I knew there was something important going on with mythology and storytelling in psychology. And I didn't have the words yet to articulate this feeling into an understanding, because Pacifica focuses on Jungian depth psychology paired with myth. So a lot of like psychological structure and meaning and archetypes. And I ate it all up. It was just totally my jam. But I dropped with my master's. So I have my master's because I realized I could harness that learning really well in storytelling for games. So I kind of like leapt like a leap of faith into this degree. And the leap of faith was rewarded with like actually high utility value of like what I learned. I use it every day.
What are the basic elements of a good story to you?
The basic elements of a good story. So we have to recognize ourselves in that story somehow. We have to feel like the stakes are important to us. There has to be movement through the story. Like people have to change by the end of the story. And by people, I mean characters. They need to arrive somewhere new, and maybe it's somewhere bad or maybe it's somewhere good, but there has to be a change. Now, dramatic change is awesome. I'm a fan of dramatic change, but you know, more nuanced change is possible. That's like all of like the lit community, right? I really personally like to work with archetypes, because archetypes are a lot of information packed into a really tiny package, and you can express a lot with knowing who the underlining archetypes are for your people, because stories are about people. And you can convey a lot of information and meaning through that shorthand, which most of us share pretty ubiquitously.
When you're developing a story, whether it's for a AAA game or an indie game or a tabletop RPG, where do you go to find inspiration? Do you have a process when you're developing a story? And is that process consistent, or does it vary from project to project or by type of project?
So the process definitely varies. The processes can be wildly different. But where the storytelling energy comes from is actually pretty consistent. I'm pretty inward looking. So I know that I will have a feeling or like a complex psychological structure that I need to communicate, to express that. I mean, that's the whole of Bluebeard's Bride and Hala Vista. And I will chase that thing down and kill it like a wildebeest, really make sure to get it right. that's more flexible in indie projects. Like, you have that control, you have the time to take to really get it right. So for bigger projects like a AAA game, you still need to build the soul of the game first. Like, you need to understand what it is. What are the immutable parts? What gives it its identity? And then through the dev process, you have to shepherd the soul through to make sure it survives contact with, you know, integration. So that by the time consumers get it, they feel that this game has a real soul. That's very important to me. And that it's possible they are moved by it. That's the whole shebang. That's why I'm in this business, is to make people feel things and evolve, you know, integration. And yeah, I really want to know a game's identity. And I also want to know where a game leaves people, like, where's the emotional end for consumers or viewers. So I'll actually, like, after I have the concept, I will do the end first and I will work backwards to make sure the scaffolding can actually get you there.
That's interesting. So you develop the end and then you work backwards to, or for mm-hmm. backwards. Yeah. Backwards. Toward the front. Yeah.
Yeah. So the middle of a game is actually the part I do last. It's not worse or anything. I just know for sure what structures are going to need to be there to carry all of that energy forward to the end and arrive somewhere meaningful.
You've won a number of awards. You mentioned them for your games, and I think you won a personal award as well. What does winning awards for your work and for your games, what does it mean to you personally, and how does it change your career trajectory?
Yeah, so on a personal level, it's like some validation that my views and my values and, like, my expression is important. But I'm actually much more strategic in my thinking in terms of about my career. Like, I'm a woman of color. I'm pretty young and people don't like that I exist, actually. Like I get threatened just for doing my job and not causing controversy. So what awards are protection and leverage. It's a way to sell executives on my value, because they're just not going to trust that I have value otherwise. It shows people that I consistently produce high quality games. And that also, if you let me off the leash, like, if you're not micromanaging me, will do wonderful things for you. Awards are part of survival for me, which is why I like them. But, like, I don't, like, sit around and, like, count on my trophies and, like, be like, I'm the best. Mostly I'm just concerned with continuing to grow as an artist.
Honestly, that's not quite the answer I expected that you would say, because I never, obviously, have different perspectives because we come from different places. So, you know, thank you for sharing something that's so personal.
Oh, what did you think I was going to answer? I'm really curious.
I thought, well, you know, awards are great and they're going to help me to get to the next level. Sure. But I didn't quite piece it together as this is why it's going to help me get to the next level, because I need to do more than perhaps somebody else might have to do to prove that I'm just as good as the next person who might be applying for a creative director job or a senior narrative designer job, right? I wouldn't have put those two things together.
Yep. Well, happy to have enlightened.
The best part of this show is sort of learning about all of this stuff that I don't know or don't experience. So thank you for that. More generally, for people who are interested in getting into the gaming industry, because of course, when we're talking to folks, they're all in the gaming industry, but when I'm talking to fans, they're all like, I want to work in the gaming industry too. How do I get there? What do you think is the most challenging thing for people to break into the industry for the first time? And what advice, if any, would you be able to share about getting into the field?
I have a lot of advice. I'll try to keep it concise. So first of all, you need a portfolio. Like, you have to have a portfolio if you want to get hired. Now, indie production, self-production on itch.io or anything else, totally different ballgame. You have much more accessible. But if you want to work for someone, if you want to work for a studio, you need a portfolio. And what we are looking at in portfolios is that you know how to write to players. There's a really distinct difference between like fiction authors and narrative designers in games. Fiction authors get to like be like, this character is really cool and adventurous and the best, and here's my story. And narrative designers go, okay, how do I trick the player into feeling like they're awesome, or they're not awesome, or that they're the center of the story? And it's a mental switch that I see a lot of people kind of like run into a brick wall the first time they come over, especially to tabletop, because you have to, as I said earlier, build the box which the player occupies. Narrative design is really about empathy and understanding the player and understanding the player's psychology, and building things that they will like. Very different from like building a fantasy world in a novel. They're two different skills. So that's the big thing we look for. We also look for in games very concise writing, because we don't have space. So you better be very succinct. If you're writing game dialogue, for instance, cut it in half. Use as few words as humanly possible. Maybe you'll get to the right place. But really, if you're going to take this seriously, find a mentor. There are lots of people willing to mentor in both tabletop and video games. And usher you through that first portfolio like setup. It's very valuable. I have mentors. I have as many as I can get. And it's a really important aspect that is kind of hidden if you don't stop to think about it. How you find mentors is you get involved in the community. You attend conferences either online or in person. You ask good questions. You follow up with people. You play games and talk about games. You form a network. Half of this is just like being in contact with other humans and doing that part well, which is a different kind of skill too. So it's also highly competitive and saturated market. Like, this is a passion industry. This is not a you do this for the money industry. And like, the industry knows it. So they're going to be able to take their pick. And it might take like a little bit to like find your first FTE, full-time job in games, if you can do that in tabletop at all these days. Video games, it's actually more likely. And you do actually have to work pretty hard. Which if it's a passion industry, like hopefully you're motivated to do so, but it's not a breeze.
It's more than just writing a campaign Bible at home and putting it online and saying, hey, hire me, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if your campaign gets like national recognition and like goes viral on YouTube or something, but the portfolio is what matters.
What elements make a good portfolio? Like, what would you say that you would include in a portfolio for somebody who is just starting out?
So video game and tabletop will be different. Mm-hmm. Video game dialogue, barks, which is like command prompt dialogue, which is very, very short. And then something that demonstrates a narrative branching, like that you understand how to do narrative branching, usually through prototypes in Twine, which is a really accessible tool. What is the last thing? One second. Oh yeah, lore prose. So object lore prose. So how do you describe this gun? How do you describe this magic wand? And all of those things should be imbued with personality and like high ability to reuse. Like, if you hear a line over and over again and you really hate it, it's not a good line. Right. And we've all experienced those lines in video games where it's like, oh, can you please shut up, NPC? Like, you're saying this for the fifth time. Like, I guess this bass is a C+, like, like Animal Crossing. You just want to kill it.
Yeah.
For tabletop, it looks different. So you need to think about narrative design, and you need to prove that you understand narrative design by making a cool one. So that means a mechanic, usually, that has lots of flavor, that is narrative driven, as opposed to like a fight mechanic or, you know, stat blocks. Stat blocks can be useful if you're specifically aiming for WotC, but like, you know, that's one company. So good narrative design, good prose, like your literary prose need to be pretty sharp, like no errors, you know how to conjugate, you don't leave hanging participles, like, you know, and I would encourage folks to use the Chicago Manual style. That is the standard for most companies. And make sure everything just looks good in your prose. If you have produced whole games, like whole indie games, even if they're very little, on your own and, you know, put them on itch or someplace else, that's fabulous. They don't even have to be like the best games, but if you can show you can do the process from beginning to end, that's going to get you a lot of points.
I'm glad you ended a little bit on tabletop, because I'd like to pivot to Van Richten's Guide. You recently contributed to that book, and it was just released over a month ago now, I guess. How did you join the project, and what was it like working with the D&D team?
Yeah, so I'm actually really good friends with Wes Snyder, who was the editor on this book and the go-to guy that made sure that this book happened. My husband actually signed on first. He wrote the Calicary setting. I wrote the Valishkan setting. And he was happily working on it. And Wes actually was like, do you want to write one too? And I didn't have the time, actually. Like, I was really busy at work at Hidden Path. And I was like, I don't think I can squeeze this in. So I said no. This is a pattern with me. I say no the first time. And then a couple months later, Wes came back and he's like, hey, someone dropped out. Can you pinch hit for me? And I'm like, yeah, if the project really needs someone to help it get through, I'll absolutely do that for you. So I wrote Valachan. It was a really simple process. You get the prompt, you have a template, you fill it out, you have like one round of feedback, and then they take it to editing from there, was my experience.
What was the most exciting thing about working on a book like Ravenloft, where you're building out a setting that people are going to be able to interact with and build worlds in?
So that's actually my forte, is generative, like world building, like being the starting place on which things are built, is my jam. I do that naturally. So I was really excited about Valachan, one, because like I had enough control to like say what goes. I proposed Chacuna, who is the Dark Lord of Valachan, to Wes, and he was like, sounds good. I could have proposed somebody else. And, you know, I love horror, obviously, and Ravenloft is one of my favorites. And we are presented with an opportunity to like move Ravenloft forward. Right? Like not backward looking, but like, how are we going to present this to future generations, to current 10-year-olds or 13-year-olds or 16-year-olds who are going to grow into this game over time? It should reflect them, right? Because your game should reflect your people. And so Valachan was really interesting because the original Dark Lord started out as like an actual panther, was changed into a dude vampire by a Red Wizard of Thay. And he was a black character. He was one of the only canonically black Dark Lords. And he was human for a while. And then he like seduced a woman. And then the wizard changed him back into a panther, basically while they were having sex, and he like murdered her. And I was like, whoo, okay. You know, we got to do some updates here. So to me, like, this was a person who is being exploited and did terrible things at the same time. And he's still a bad dude. Like, they don't cancel each other out. They actually just both exist at the same time And it was a colonial thematics to the original Valachan. Like, these people are colonized, you know, they're being ruled by this guy. It's not a fun deal. And so my thinking was like, okay, if you take the colonizer out of the picture, does that actually solve anything in this setting, in a horror setting, not real life? And I was like, no, like, the harmed perpetuate harm sometimes. And to overthrow a person that awful and powerful, you have to become awful and powerful, right? So the tragedy and the horror is like, you escaped, but you didn't escape. You actually just bought into what was already being done to everybody. And now you're in charge, which is horrifying. And that's really what Jacuna is it's like, she failed to get free of colonialism. She's actually perpetuating all of the systems that the old Dark Lord set up, and she is trapped by it, right? She's magically tied to the land. And if she doesn't appease the land, it will murder everybody. It, like, all the trees and the vines and the animals and the bunnies will just rise up and destroy all humanoids. So what do? You continue to survive. And I thought it was poignant. Like, I'll admit, I was like, okay, this says some things. It has some nuance, and I'm really happy with that.
And in theory, if somebody was to defeat the Dark Lord, they would either have to take her place or the domain would just fall into chaos, right?
Yeah, they would die. Their whole party would die. That's the cool thing. Valachan is one of the only settings where a player can become a Dark Lord. Like there's a real path to that. But it's not a cool path, right? Like, if you're driven to that to survive, you get trapped too. So it's just the themes, like, reiterating themselves. Like, this is a reality that you can't escape.
The Van Richten's introduces the concept of safety tools, of approaching horror in a sensitive way. It highlights some of the traditional tropes that are recognized now as being unpalatable. How much of this did you know about in advance? Did you know that the D&D, this book was going in this direction, or did you sort of find out after the book released?
I mean, I don't think we ever explicitly talked about it, but a lot of us share the same values, right? I've been using the X card in my games for years, and Bluebeard's Bride has to have safety tools because it is such a violent, visceral, dark game. Safety tools actually empower you to be more edgy, actually, because you have a way to communicate boundaries. It means you can push right up to them, and you can trust that the system will help you do that. Whereas if you're just kind of groping blind with people you don't know, like, you can overstep, you can miss opportunities. Like, it's a communication tool, and it actually lets you get closer to the horror. Like, play Bluebeard's Bride without the X card and see what happens. Actually, don't do that. But, like, when you use it, it empowers you to get, like, really nasty sometimes, because it's a mechanism where the boundaries will be known. And my philosophy is, like, if you're sitting down to play a tabletop game, you're playing to have fun. That's the universal rule. Fun sometimes looks like being terrified. Fun sometimes looks like comedy. But if someone is not having fun, right? If a DM pulls something on them and it's not, they don't enjoy it. Like, why are you even there? Like, you should stop the game because there's no point. So I think, you know, I just assumed that this is how things work in the indie community for years, that WotC would finally pick it up for their new horror setting. And it was kind of like, through osmosis, I was like kind of casually right. So
I know you're working on your own tabletop RPG book right now. Is it at a stage where you can chat with me a little bit about what you're working on and what you're hoping to provide the community with this new book?
Yeah, so I was very fortuitous to land a literary agent late last year, or early this year. I don't know, time in 2020 was weird. And I am writing a nonfiction book, actually, my first one, on making tabletop games. So if you've never made your own tabletop game before and you want to, this book is kind of a manual of like actually how to do that. Like, here are the basics of design. Here are the things you need to consider. Here's how you put them together. Here's how you play test it. And like, here's where you can go with your game when it's done. And the idea is like, I think game design should be accessible to as many people as possible. You shouldn't have to get lucky and join a Google Plus community to like gain those skills. And you know, that like, I would love for this to make game design more accessible for minority folks who are sometimes at the edge of these spaces and not centered, so that there's just more empowerment to do what they want, to make the settings they want, to make the flavors of horror or comedy or adventure they want, you know, unique to their lived experiences. Because that just makes our industry richer. It makes our storytelling richer. And we also evolve like how games work. Like, mechanics are always in flux. Like, they're always evolving as we design, especially in the indie community. And I want to see that momentum keep going.
Okay. Yeah. No, that sounds great. I mean, fundamentally, especially now, it feels like there are more and more people who are getting involved in tabletop RPGs. They've played Dungeons and Dragons. They have an idea about what they want to do, but they don't really know how to do it. So it feels like it would be a good tool to help them develop the game they've always wanted to see, but never could.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Strix, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you? And can you give a little bit of insight into what you're working on at present?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. That's where I live. On Twitter, I'm the_Strix, Strix. You can find my website through there and see all the things that I'm doing. And I mean, besides the book, everything I'm working on is NDA. I mean, I'm like, classic to me, like, I'm not just working on this AAA game. Yeah. Can't help myself with doing side projects. But they're just not announceable right now.
Got it. Well, hopefully when you have the opportunity to chat a little bit more about the AAA D&D game, which you have talked about in the sense that you're doing it, but you can't say anything about, I'd love to have you back and maybe we can chat a bit more about it.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks so much, Gary.
That's our show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. If you made it this far but haven't subscribed yet, that's impressive, and I commend you. You still could, it's not too late. It's always good having you join me, and remember, if the die is cocked, it doesn't count. I look forward to chatting with you again next week.